from Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war.
In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, host Dr. Lewis Sorley talks with Robert Caron, the pilot of the last helicopter evacuation in Saigon as the Vietnam War came to a close.
Welcome to Veterans Chronicles. This is Lewis Sorley, nicknamed Bob, and our guest this week is Robert Caron, who will be talking to us by telephone from his home in Fort Walton Beach. You know a Bob Caron, even though you may not know that, because he's in one of the most famous photographs from the Vietnam War. You can't see him, but he's there. The photograph is of a helicopter on the roof of a building with a long line of people ascending a ladder or staircase waiting to board that helicopter, which is the last evacuation flight from Saigon on the day Saigon fell and the Vietnam War came to an end. Bob's the pilot of that aircraft. Welcome, Bob. I'm so glad we have a chance to talk with you.
My pleasure, Bob.
Now, I have to tell our audience that you and I know each other rather well, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
And for a long time.
Oh, I hate to think. No, I don't. It's a pleasure. Long time, and time has gone by quick.
That we're getting an opportunity today to put your remarkable story into the historical record. You know that the American Veterans Center exists to recognize and record the stories of America's veterans, and your story is a great one. So thanks for being on with us this morning. I'd like to start with some discussion of your early years and how you got to West Point. So could you tell us a little about that, please?
Well, it was kind of a dream from the eighth grade on, but of course it would never have happened had I not had a great deal of luck. As I was saying earlier, perhaps, My early family life was somewhat less than desirable, wound up in several foster homes, of which some were okay, some were not so good. But during that time, the young lady that placed us in the homes working for the New York State was connected with Senator Arthur Wicks. And somehow, she took a liking to me right away. And as years passed, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, she got introduced him to me and me to his family, and they liked me. And I worked hard, was a good student, this sort of thing, you know, nothing really great. And he instantly liked me, and he said he decided that if I wanted to go to West Point, he would do his best to help me. And then it went on from there.
What kind of an appointment did you receive to the Military Academy?
Congressional. I think his name was Congressman Wharton. I still remember that for some reason.
Uh-huh.
But at the Senator Wicks, early on, was a great, great leader.
Well, I think you've told me in the past that you had shown some leadership ability in high school, not only student council president, but also captain of the football and track teams. Now, that's the kind of guy West Point's looking for, so I'm sure you helped yourself a great deal.
Did my best, Bob.
What happened to you once we graduated? What branch did you choose, and what kind of training did you enter into?
Oh, artillery, of course.
and I
loved artillery, and I had a great time. As you know, upon graduation, we were required to do jump school, ranger school, or as then developed aviation school, and I was lucky enough to go to jump school, which was a lot of fun, then go to aviation school. And then I got my first assignment in Darmstadt, Germany, where I served with a 280-millimeter gun battalion, which was early on the only nuclear artillery piece in the world.
I remember seeing those big monsters out in the field when I was there with the 2nd Armored Cavalry.
Yeah, where were we? Were you near Fulda, Bob, up there, or were you further to the east?
I was down in Amberg, east of Nuremberg, in
a
squadron that was there. But we saw those big 280-millimeter guns trying to make their way on those twisty German roads. It wasn't easy, was it?
Oh, my goodness. For a long time, we were the only 280-millimeter battalion not to have turned one over because, as you say, it was tricky. They had the big gun, which was picked up by a forward A unit and a B unit in the rear, and it was very difficult, and it was difficult because not every road, every bridge could take us. That would made it hard.
I have a memory of seeing at least one of those on its side, and getting it back up could not have been easy.
Well, I think the gun alone weighed like, I think 50 tons or close to that, Bob.
The
tool weighed like 22 tons. It was massive.
Did you maintain your flying proficiency during that artillery assignment?
Oh, yeah. What happens, we were assigned as a pilot, and the battalion had two L-19s and two pilots.
Right.
And then if we were fortunate, we were allowed to go on ground duty for 1 year.
Yes.
I had the great pleasure of serving under Captain McDonald, who won the DSC in Korea because he had to call artillery down in his own position because being overrun by the Chinese.
But
he's also a great administrator. And one of my regrets in my life is I didn't realize early on what a great leader he was, both military, administratively, and on the battlefield.
Well, speaking of battlefields, our war was coming up right away, wasn't it? You were one of the earlier members of our class to go to Vietnam, I think.
Not all that early. We had people like Sam Kam, I think Art Boudreau, and others that were there like maybe 63, and Ward Lahardy, maybe even 62. So when I got there in late 65 after the first cab, I wasn't all that early.
Where were you assigned, and what did you do on that tour in Vietnam?
My initial year, we went over with the Chinook outfit, the CH-47s, and we were stationed at a horrible place called Mung Tau, which, if you recollect, was the R&R center for the troops.
A lovely place to be, but tell us about the Chinook, because not everybody will know what that bird was like.
It's the one you see on TV in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's the huge twin rotor helicopter.
What missions did you usually get when you were there?
Well, it did a lot of moving of guns, moving of ammo. We picked up when there were crashes of Caribou fighters and stuff like that. We moved a lot of those aircraft back to the maintenance facility.
In a typical day, how much flying would you do?
Oh, Bob, I don't know. Looking back, sometimes 4 or 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the big helicopters like that, the old saying was for every hour you flew, like 8 to 10 hours of maintenance. So,
right.
There was a time when we flew 6, 7, 8 hours a day for probably 6, 7, 8 birds. But then what happened later on in 66, we kind of ran out of parts because the difficulty of logistics from, you know, the state's 10,000 miles away.
Now, I think there came a point maybe early 1966 when you took part in a very special mission. Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, that was something that always confused me. We got a request from Army headquarters, MACV, to take two helicopters and fly to Thailand and then on into Vientiane, Laos. And as I recall, we were given minimal briefings, and we were just told where to go, what to do a little bit. So we made our mission planning, flew over Blake Coup. We refueled at Doc To, which I think later on became a very prominent Special Forces camp.
Yes.
Then actually overflew Laos right there in the Pak Say area. I think the town near that was Adapu, which may at that time may have been in bad guy hands, control.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew there, landed at Ubon, refueled, went on up to Udorn, and got our briefing that we would pick up a TACAN somewhere in the Vientiane, Laos area.
Wait, could you explain what a TACAN is for our listeners,
please? TACAN is the, it's like a VOR, it's a communication thing for aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And what it tells you is you're exactly this azimuth or heading from the TACAN itself and exactly how many miles. So Air Force people could bomb in bad weather and so forth with great accuracy.
Right. So you took this thing to this, hilltop, huh?
Yeah, it was a huge hilltop. We followed an Air America Porter from Ben Chan up there. We didn't know where the heck we were. And moved it up on the top of the hill. And I even got some pictures today of that. And you look straight down, it's really an unbelievable hill. That's why it stuck out of my memory so good. And later on, this place, which became known as Site 85, when I heard about the fall and so forth, I just was so confused because I said, I know I did this in 66, you know, my brain is working. So how could they have fallen in 68?
Yes.
Then what happened, in a little research, I found out that, heck, it had been overrun years before in the late 50s.
A famous site for being overrun, right?
Well, and I think like the Greeks said, what was it, Thermopylae or somewhere, that some traitor led the bad guys up a secret path.
I see. Now, I believe you extended after this your initial one-year tour there. What happened during the extended period?
Well, at Vung Tau, I had the pleasure of serving alongside the 61st Caribou Unit, and I had several good friends in there. Matter of fact, my stick buddy was there. He was a young warrant officer who, believe it or not, later became a full colonel and fought in the Iraq War and passed away a few years ago because of some kind of disease he encountered during that combat.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, well, I will stay over here for another 6 months to a year if I can fly caribou.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, sounds fine. You've got time in the caribou, da, 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 and away to go.
Okay,
then about November, my friend said, Bob, forget it. I said, what do you mean forget it?
Stand by, Bob. We're going to take a break here.
Okay.
And then we'll continue our conversation with Robert Caron, who is the pilot of the last helicopter to lift off from a roof in Saigon.
Coming up, Caron describes the circumstances on this famous mission.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are through your MP3 player. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, now online at radioamerica.org.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. And now back to Veterans Chronicles host Dr. Louis Sorley and Robert Caron, the pilot of the last helicopter evacuation in Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. This is Louis Sorley, and we are continuing our conversation with Robert Caron, the pilot of the last helicopter to lift off a roof in Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War. Bob, you were on this extension of your service in Vietnam, and I think you wound up flying out of Tan Son, where you met some interesting people. Pick it up there and tell us what happened, please.
Okay. When I couldn't go to the Caribou unit, I said, well, what's the next best thing? And eventually wound up with the MACV flight detachment. And if I may just say a thing about it, Bob, it was a wonderful flying experience with fixed wing mostly, but I was able to meet several Hollywood types that came into the Vietnam to talk to the troops. But while I was there, I looked across the ramp, across there, and I saw these blue-type airplanes and eventually realized that they were Air America, and then I found out what Air America was and decided at some point in time that might be something that I'd like to do. So I put my paperwork in, and surprisingly, they said, okay, I could go. And I went back to the same APO I left and just 100 yards across the ramp to the other place.
Now, was there any training involved in the transition, or did you just basically jump in the cockpit and keep on doing what you'd been doing?
Well, we went to ground school. The airplanes which they had were kind of antiquated, like the C-45. There was a transition into that. We did ground school, which is kind of normal. And then we did flight training in Bangkok and later on Vientiane. then reported to our first duty station, which at that time for me was Saigon.
So how long did this period of your career last?
It lasted from early 68, 69. Then in spring of 69, I think his name was Red Dawson, came by. He's a personnel man out of Washington. And at that time, even, it was clear that America had kind of peaked manpower-wise. And as a co-pilot, I was never going to see Captain in the fixed wing. So I asked him, would it be possible to go into helicopters, because I did have a lot of chopper time.
Yes.
He said, he'd look into it and let me know. And then 2 months later, I got a Twix from Washington, get your butt up to Udon, Thailand. Now, that was a more difficult one, because I had not flown choppers in a while, and I've never even been up inside a CH-34.
Where was your family during all this time?
Initially, I didn't have one.
Mm-hmm.
Then I married a young woman, and she was with me in Saigon. And then she, let me see. I got a thing back here, Bob. No, we got married in 69, see, so she wasn't there. And we went to Thailand. She was with me there. I was there about 4 years, almost five. Then moved back to Saigon later on, back to in the end of 73. And then, when the things got a little warm there in Saigon, most all the family shipped out. Some went back to the States. Some stayed nearby in Manila and Bangkok and so forth.
Tell me what the situation looked like to you at the time they started to send the families away and so on.
Well, the bad guys were on the move, and I don't recall, you probably know a lot more accurately than I do, Bob, when everything started to look bad. But it was pretty clear, even in March, that they were moving south from Da Nang, moving through the middle of the country, Bleku. I recall flying out of Nha Trang and hearing the customer people talking about one of their people was on the ground and that they were having difficulty maintaining contact. And later on, it turned out he was indeed captured, and I don't know if he was returned or not. But There was always that air that things were not going well, and though we didn't pay a lot of attention to it, there was a lot of discussion of the way Congress was acting, withdrawing funds, curtailing any support for the Vietnamese, and most folks knew that it may be just a matter of time, might take a miracle to survive, but we didn't know when, and we thought, you know, it might be 6 months to a year. Nobody could realize or anticipate how fast things went to hell there in March and then April.
In the spring of 1975, at the end of March, General Fred Wyand, who was then the Army Chief of Staff, was sent by the President on a fact-finding mission out to Vietnam. And I think you met him then and dealt with him.
Yes, I did. And there's a real wonderful gentleman, and he actually flew, I think, several missions. Our particular mission was, I believe, around the end of March, the 31st, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to go around and see what was going on, and he wanted to go to a little place northwest of Saigon called Lai Khe. And so we went to Ben Wap, actually right there, Thao Chan Nu, picked him up. And as we're flying up there, I turned around from my seat, and I said, "General, would like to tell you that the last time I was in Lai Khe, they boarded us." And the general kind of smiled, turned around to his man on the scene there, Colonel, I think it may have been Colonel Hogue, something like that. "Hey, what do you think, Colonel?" Colonel, "Well, I don't think there'd be any problem. We haven't heard of anything." And general said, "Okay, we'll press on." About 10 minutes later, we're about halfway up there. Air America Operations called me and said, "Bob, got bad news for you. Lai Khe's being mortared."
Let's stop there for a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Robert Caron.
Up next, Mr. Caron explains the complexity involved in mass evacuations during wartime.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
We cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. And now back to Veterans Chronicles host Dr. Lewis Sorley and Robert Caron, the pilot of the famous last helicopter evacuation in Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. This is Lewis Sorley, and we are continuing our conversation with Robert Caron. Bob, things, as you wrote to me recently, were by then looking bleak. You said we all moved to buildings that had helicopter pads on the roof. Let's pick the story up there. What happened to you specifically at that point?
Several folks were involved in checking out rooftops, and I was talking to Nicky Filippi, who did a lot of that. He was one of the IPs that checked me out in the Huey upon my return to Saigon. But they had to do it so carefully because the word was from the embassy, don't let people know what you're doing. In other words, when they found a rooftop that was suitable, they couldn't go in and bang away and remove obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
They had to cut it with a acetylene torch so they could do it quietly, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But they had about 20, 25 places, and they finally reduced that down to about 10 or 15. And then the object was, if things do go to hell in a handbasket, then we want people to get to those places where they can be airlifted out. And then to do that, of course, we had to have some Air America crews standing by overnight at Tansanoot.
Now, when you say some people, would you explain what people we're speaking of now that are potential evacuees?
Families.
Of Vietnamese or Americans or both?
Well, the embassy people, of course, the
mm-hmm.
aid people,
mm-hmm.
the agency people, but we anticipated tons and tons of families. You can't believe, Bob, how many people that I knew stopped me going to and from work, wanted to know if I could help them get out of the country, you know?
Yes.
And mostly I had to tell them, no, I didn't have any way of doing it. I didn't personally imagine the thousands of people that were trying to get out, you know?
Yes.
You've seen pictures of people at the embassy gates and so forth.
Yes.
Trying to get in and with the difficulty of, or rather lateness of the word to go, a lot of names were not protected in computers and paperwork and stuff like that. So the good guys for us that worked for us were quickly found out by the Viet Cong who was what and where, and they were picked up, sent to re-education camps and so forth.
When and how did you get the word to swing into action in evacuating people?
I wasn't that dumb, so I located the nearest place I could to the airport, Bob, and that was a place called the First Hotel. And I'm sure it's still there with a different name. In fact, I visited it in 92, and it does have a different name. But I was there, and somehow, I don't know if I talked to Dave Kendall earlier or not, but he picked me up on that particular day. On that day especially, well, let me back up, if I may, just a minute. They had the aircraft that strafed the palace, the presidential palace, and that then they put the town under martial law. We couldn't go anywhere. So people I tried to help my wife's cousin, Phan Thi Mong, to get out. I couldn't contact her, get her to the First Hotel so I could airlift her out.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened, we're there 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock, And
What date are we speaking of now?
We're taking Monday, the 29th of April.
Yes.
And
the day before the fall of Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Then finally, about 10 o'clock, my friend, Fixed Wing Flight Mechanic, and I, we had a bottle of champagne. We opened that up and had the people cook us up some breakfast, and we ate breakfast, had champagne and eggs for breakfast. Then right around 11 o'clock, I heard this womp, 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 top of the roof. So I quickly run up there, myself and the other gentleman, and there was Dave Kendall waiting for us to jump in. So he took us out to Thompson Newt, which was by that time a mess of gunfire, people running around crazy, Vietnamese pilots trying to steal the Air America helicopter. And I just ran to the first one I saw, looked really quick, and jumped in it, and then we started going to rooftops, the embassy, and taking people to the large area around the commissary and PX compound.
Were you being directed where to go, or were you freelancing? How was that
just
handled?
Just kind of freelance, Bob. There's no, I got no briefing till about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Just we had been told before the rooftops were marked with an H. Just fly around. You saw people. You saw the rooftop. We had a general idea where some of the places were, but the idea was for us small helicopters to do this rooftop evacuation,
mm-hmm.
take them to the compound there by the PX and commissary, and then the large Navy aircraft would pick up, 50 to 100 at a time and take them out to the waiting ships off Vung Tau. Let me say one thing, Bob. I think the Navy did an incredible job. Primarily, we're out of fuel because the fuel truck had been moved by some safety-conscious guy that didn't know why it was put there, and the other trucks were emptied and or damaged. So we had to go out to the carriers or the Blue Ridge, the command ship, to refuel.
How long a flight was that for you in that type of aircraft?
Probably 45 minutes.
Yeah.
They're about 20 miles off the coast, They weren't as close as we thought initially because we kept flying and flying and flying. Where are they?
Was anybody flying with you? Did you have a co-pilot?
Initially, no. But after the briefing, they put a guy in with me. Way back in 71, I was shot down in Laos and had run for my life, myself and pilot named Freddie Fram. And in Air America, if we had dangerous missions, we had a special bird called the SAR bird, search and rescue. His only function in life was to pick up us if we had a problem doing our pickup. Well, this gentleman became famous for not picking up two people, me and then somebody else down at the Paxay area. And the chief pilot said, Bob, I'm going to put this guy with you. Is that a problem?
Hmm.
And I said, no, I'll manage, But, of course, it was difficult for me because every time I looked at him, I just didn't know what to think, Bob.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, is there anything I can do? I'm a vindictive sort of guy, I guess. Anything I can do? I didn't know what to do, but he solved the problem for me at the first trip out to the ships. He jumped out, and then I never saw him again.
Really?
Other than that, we were all by ourselves.
Yeah.
We had most of us had radio problems, this problem. So that's another reason why when it got dark, the people decided to just let us finish flying and let the Navy do it because they had great communications.
Was there any attempt by the enemy forces that were closing in on Saigon to interfere with what you were doing during this time? Were you being shot at or anything like that?
No, we were surprised about that, Bob, because we didn't know what to expect. We fully expected to get shot at. And some people said they were, but I'm not sure they were. They may just heard something. But I was quite surprised. And there was a rumor floating around that it's possible there was kind of like a gentleman's agreement. Okay, since you guys are nice enough to leave, we'll let you leave.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know. As far as I know, nobody took any rounds. Now, my first helicopter, when I refueled the first time right there at the Air America ramp, I had time to look it over, and I lifted up the covers on the transmission, which goes out to the tail rotor. That was a big old hole. So I immediately changed helicopters.
That's undesirable, I take it.
Yeah, a little stressful. You don't know if that's going to break. You have no tail rotor, and if you don't have no tail rotor and you're a little bit slow, all you do is spin like a time, stop, and crash and burn. But let's see.
I think you had a special mission that involved getting somebody from the embassy. Can you recall that?
Oh yeah, that's what that photograph on the rooftop is all about. I landed at the embassy rooftop, and this guy walks over like he knows what he's doing. He said, "I got something special for you." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, who are you?" He said, "I'm so-and-so." I don't even recall the name he gave me. I learned it later on, of course.
Yes.
And he said, "We need to go pick up the Deputy Prime Minister." Of course, the Vietnamese Deputy Prime Minister. I said, "Okay, get on, let's go." So we flew around. He directed me to where it was, and it was this rooftop with hardly any room for the helicopter skids to sit on. In fact, we sat on a pipe with part of the air conditioning, I think, you know.
Now, is this the famous photo?
This is the famous photo, yeah.
What kind of an aircraft are you flying?
We're flying a Huey.
And if one, like me, not knowledgeable very much about aircraft, looks at that photograph, it looks like there are a lot more people on that stairway than could fit into a Huey.
In fact, we went back one more time and picked up some more people and made one last flight out to the Hancock, the carrier Hancock, and dropped them off. And that, as you can imagine, was pretty hectic. And you've seen the stories. In fact, the guy that picked me up, Dave Kendall, is the one that ditched that helicopter in the water.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy landing guy said, "Get this thing off my ship. You know, go put it in the water." And, of course, Dave did what he was told. Of course, he got yelled at by Air America later on. So he did it. He told me the story. He said, "Bob, I trimmed it up so it would hover by itself. Then I jumped out the door."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I neglected to think, of course, in all this, what's going on, who could blame him?" He said, "When I jumped out, the center of gravity shifted. So it shifted to the rear, and the helicopter started coming back at me, and I'm in the water, scared to death."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "The last second, it kind of rolled over to the left-hand side, and the blades hit the water and stuff like that." But even that's dangerous because there's so much stuff flying around.
Now, did you stay aboard the ship, and was that the way that you got back to home eventually, or what happened?
Incredible story, Bob. I got on board the ship. The next day, I flew to the command ship, the Blue Ridge. I'm not sure why, whether because they didn't have enough bunks there for me or what. But I get off there, and the first two people I see are two Army buddies on a Navy ship that I knew at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Hmm.
One was Jim Clinton. The other was Bob Brown. And so they said, you can have a bunk with us. So I had a nice bunk on our last two or three days, which took us to go to Manila. But they were telling me a very interesting story that how they had spent all morning going through faxes, telegrams, and so forth, defending the admiral from the accusation by the ambassador that he totally screwed up the mission. And as they told me, admiral told the ambassador, "Once you say go, sir, I need 4 hours to get my people into Saigon, get everybody briefed, coordinated, I think overhead cover, I'm not sure." And that's exactly what it took.
Yes.
That's why when I had my meeting at 3 o'clock with my chief pilot, that was the 4 hours that the admiral had required to get his people ready.
Yes.
So I think he was accused falsely, and I don't know whatever happened to him. Maybe you do. But, you know, it was a nasty thing to do.
I have the greatest admiration for everyone involved in that evacuation. As you know, even though it was a call late and there was a restricted time, all the Americans got out, and what most people estimate is 130,000 Vietnamese. There were more that would like to have come, and as we know, many more took to boats, became the so-called boat people in their efforts to escape the communist domination. But it was a great job, and your part in it is quite dramatic. I'm going to ask you in a minute just to sort of tell us briefly what happened to you after this all occurred. You know, did you stay with Air America?
No. When we got to Manila, we got the word Air America was going to fold, and we were going to be paid up till August. But then cut loose and returned to America, given a ticket back to America, and that was about it. Pretty quick, pretty sudden. And
where did you go?
I went back to Fort Lauderdale.
When were you and your family?
My senator friend lived, so I went back, stayed near him for about a year.
When were you and your family reunited?
We went to Hong Kong, did all our out processing, collected some back pay. Then I got a flight to Bangkok, where I reunited with my wife and daughter.
Yes.
We were there for about a month. Then we returned to the U.S.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center.